Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to your Green Job sponsored conference call. All lines have been placed on a listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions and comments following the presentation. If you should require assistance throughout today's conference, please press star zero to reach a live operator. At this time, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Bracken Hendricks. Sir, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for joining us today. My name is Bracken Hendricks. I'm a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. The Center for American Progress is a nonpartisan research and educational institute dedicated to promoting strong, just, and free America that ensures opportunity for all. And I want to thank you for joining the call. This morning, we are focusing on a new report by CAP and the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts. The report is titled Green Recovery, a program to create good jobs and start building a low-carbon economy. Before we begin, I want to give you some contact information in case there are follow-up questions. You can contact John Neurohr at the Center for American Progress press office. His email is jneurohr@americanprogress.org, John Neurohr at americanprogress.org. The report is available both on the CAP website, americanprogress.org, and at the Political Economy Research Institute website, www.peri.umass.edu. And I will be introducing the speakers today in turn as they speak. The first speaker is going to be John Podesta, the President and CEO of the Center for American Progress. And I'll turn it over to you, John.
Thank you all for joining us today. And I'll try to be quite brief. We have a number of people who will make brief presentations, and then we'll turn it open to questions. But I think, as you all know, the U.S. today is simultaneously facing an energy crisis and an economic crisis. Just 5 days ago, the nation's latest job report was released, showing that unemployment had spiked to 6.1%, the highest unemployment rate in 5 years. Since the beginning of this year, the U.S. economy has lost 605,000 jobs, 84,000 jobs in August alone. And you're also all aware that we're facing an energy crisis. This report indicates that by making a rapid green economic investment strategy, we can create over 2 million jobs in 2 years. By investing in the green economy, we create good jobs, increase our energy independence, and reduce the greenhouse gas emissions that cause global warming. So I think it's critical that we attack both of these problems simultaneously. The Center for American Progress has previously put out a report capturing the energy opportunity, creating a low-carbon economy, which focuses on a 10-year program to transform our economy from a high-carbon to a low-carbon base. But it was our view that we needed to kind of jumpstart that activity to really begin to address the deep economic problems that the country faces today. So we commissioned Bob Polin and his team at Perry to take a look at what a $100 billion green economic recovery program could do to the U.S. economy, to model it, to strengthen the U.S. economy over the next few years, and leave it in a better position to for sustainable prosperity. Investments in renewable energy, energy efficiency are central to the proposed economic recovery program, which is modeled in this report using direct public federal expenditures, tax credits, and loan guarantees to spur private sector investment. That $100 billion investment would create 2 million jobs over the course of 2 years. To give you some indication of the size of this, the last stimulus package that was passed earlier this year was $168 billion. To give it some, some kind of context about what we could spend over 2 years. I think importantly, I'll just make a couple of other points. This is the spending $100 billion in this fashion on green energy and on retrofitting buildings, expanding mass transit, constructing smart electrical grid transmission systems, on wind power, on solar power, on next generation biofuels, would create four times more jobs than spending the same amount would spending it on the oil industry, and 300,000 more jobs than spending directly towards household consumption. So it's a solid long-term program that begins to address our energy needs, create a sustainable platform, but it creates good jobs would help reduce our unemployment rate over the next 2 years from the high level that we see now to 4.4%, and it particularly boosts and bolsters employment in construction and manufacturing, which has taken a massive hit as a result of the housing bubble collapse. So it provides career ladders for people getting out of poverty and into good-paying jobs. It provides a mix of jobs at the lower end, at the skilled labor end, and at the high investment end. And we think it's a solid prospect for doing, as I said, addressing both these twin problems of our energy crisis and our economic crisis. And we look forward to its consideration as a new Congress and with a new administration.
Great. Now I'm going to turn the microphone over to Bob Polin, who is co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at University of Massachusetts Amherst, Perry. And Bob, you can take the mic.
Thank you. Thanks, Bracken, for the opportunity to speak today. I was very impressed that John Podesta hit on basically all the points I was about to make. So obviously the main messages of this report that we've written are getting through. And so I can be very brief. The program, as John said, it's a $100 billion investment program over 2 years. And it's focused on creating 2 million jobs by investing in six green investment areas, building retrofit, mass transit and freight rail, smart grid, solar and wind power, and next generation biomass fuels. The program is designed such that the money and jobs can be distributed equitably across all states and communities. In fact, we take some pains in the report to show how the money can be distributed equitably. And this is independent of geography or climate advantages. So this is not just a program for states that have a lot of wind rushing through them or enjoy a lot of sun all year. We can think of that in terms of the example of building retrofits. Obviously, all communities have buildings. And all of those buildings, or most of them, are operating inefficiently. And so a large-scale program of retrofitting those buildings will create lots of jobs in all communities, and it will also drive down energy costs and will reduce carbon emissions into the atmosphere. John mentioned the situation with construction. A lot of the jobs that are going to be created through this program are in construction, and that meets the very severe situation in the construction industry at present. A year ago, there were 8 million people in this country working in construction. Now there's 7.2 million. That's a loss of 800,000 jobs. This program can make those jobs back. As John said, the program would create about four times more jobs per dollar spent than spending the equivalent amount of money within the oil industry. It would also create about 20% more jobs than increasing spending on household consumption, which, as you'll recall, was the main target of the April 2008 stimulus. Now, why does this program create more jobs? Without getting into a lot of detail, we can just say a couple of quick things. One is that this program is more labor-intensive. That is, for the dollars spent, we create more jobs, spend more on jobs and less on machines, less on supplies. I mean, we can compare a project of a building retrofit with, say, moving oil from Saudi Arabia to the United States, and you see what I mean. Similarly, we have a much higher, what we call domestic content. More of the money is focused within the United States than in other countries. Those are the two main drivers as to why we get more jobs. Now, most of the investments, in fact, all of the investments focused on energy efficiency will pay for themselves very quickly. For example, retrofitting public buildings, which would take about $26 billion overall if we were to retrofit each and every public building in the United States now, that project would pay for itself within 5 years through energy savings. We would get even more energy savings through retrofitting individual family homes. Those would tend, on average, to pay for themselves within 3 years. So while we're talking about expenditures up front, the money comes back very, very quickly. I would finally just add that this report is one installment of a fuller study that my colleagues here at the University of Massachusetts and I were going to be doing with CAP, which will cover the issues of green investments and jobs, both within the short term, as we're doing now, and over a longer term. Thanks.
Very good. Thank you, Bob. And now I'm going to turn the floor over to Leo Girard, who is the International President of the United Steelworkers, the largest international union, manufacturing union in North America.
Thanks, Bracken. Let me just say that coming after the last two speakers, I reiterate that everything that I wanted to say has been said. But let me try to focus in on a couple of points. First of all, it's important for folks to start thinking about what are green jobs. And in many cases, when we talk about green jobs, those are enhancing some already existing jobs. As an example, there's 26 tons, roughly, give or take a few tons on an average size windmill, 26 tons of steel. With the slight increase we've had in America on windmill production for wind energy, we've already had to reopen and reinvigorate two plate mills in the United States that were barely hanging on 5 years ago. They're now producing plate for the wind industry. When we talk about retrofitting buildings, I think that we can create millions of jobs in A, retrofitting those buildings, and B, making the products to retrofit those buildings, from energy-efficient glass to solar panels to more modern air handling systems and air distribution systems, all of which using taxpayer dollars to retrofit, as an example, public buildings. If we retrofitted all of the public buildings in America and incented private buildings to retrofit, we could have those products made in America, and we create tens of thousands of jobs making those products, as well as reinstalling and renovating the existing buildings. If we were to promote high-efficiency transportation, that high-efficiency transportation with high-mileage vehicles that are produced in America, that would create jobs in America in not only the steel industry, but in the auto parts industry, that we'd be able to have those cars made in America as opposed to being imported from someplace else. We could retrofit the energy grid, where we currently lose a large portion of energy on the grid, and that lost energy, folks who currently run the grid, they don't mind it if you lose it, because you have to ship that much more. Those that ship the energy don't mind if you lose it, because you have to ship that much more. So we could save. If we were to make massive investments in energy-efficient appliances, in addition to the energy-efficient cars, we create thousands of jobs. So from the point of view of the Steelworkers Union, our view is quite simple, that a energy-efficient green economy creates jobs, and they can create jobs in America. I think that one of the things we ought to look at is that if we want to have a major effect on global warming, we ought to go after the things that that produce and can reduce while creating jobs, the sort of moving to the low carbon economy. The largest emitters of carbon are old buildings, so that there's a huge benefit in the buildings. There's a large benefit from low-carbon transportation. And that would mean high-speed trains, high-speed rail. People might be shocked to know that we've lost most of the U.S. rail industry that makes rails because of the decline in rail use and the excess use of high-energy, high-carbon transportation systems. We can retrofit and redo that and have that made in America. The other thing I do want to say is that as we move to a low-carbon economy, we've got to recognize that as we negotiate trade deals, environmental issues have to be a cornerstone of any future trade arrangement, as do labor standards. And we're not trying to deal with, I'll call it Pittsburgh warming or Chicago warming or L.A. warming or New York City warming. It's, in fact, global warming. And as we negotiate future trade deals, we need to make sure that we have border adjustment mechanisms for those countries that aren't moving towards a low-carbon, high-efficiency economy. Because if we don't, what we'll simply do is export our jobs as well as exporting global warming. So I think that this study is a very important study. It lays out in very clear terms that with minimal investment in the sort of, if you think about it in this global context of the overall U.S. budget, minimal investments gets much higher rates of return than was previously acknowledged. And it also comes on the heels of a study that was done a couple of years ago by the Apollo Alliance that came to the very same conclusion. So as a member of the Blue-Green Alliance and as a member of the Apollo Alliance, the Steelworkers Union are proud to be part of this study and part of the campaign to move to a green jobs economy. And I'd be happy when we take questions as well to participate in that. Thanks, Bracken.
Great. And now I'll turn it over to Francis Beinecke, who is the president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC.
Hello.
Bracken.
Hi, Francis.
Bracken?
Yep. Hello? Can you hear me?
Maybe.
Now we can.
Great.
Now we can.
Sorry about that. I'm not sure what happened, a technical malfunction. But thank you very much, Leo. And I now turn the mic over to Francis Beinecke, who is the president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC.
Thanks, Bracken, very much. It's a pleasure for NRDC to participate in this call today. I just would like to make two specific points about the study. We're engaged in a national energy discussion right now. Congress is addressing the concerns of the nation around the price of gasoline and is considering energy legislation right now. The legislation that's being considered continues us down a dirty energy pathway, focusing on the traditional sources of energy that we've had in the past, with not enough attention to a clean energy pathway. And I think as we engage in a national debate about our energy future, this report comes at a perfect time because it really shows us both what the economic benefit is of investing in a clean energy future, but what the environmental benefit is as well. We've done a lot of research in the past on how to create green jobs. The report provides much more detail into specifically what jobs are created, how they're created around the country, and it really points the pathway, as Leo mentioned, to how we have a low-carbon future, really transform our energy future to one that is a low-carbon basis, and really provides the substantiation for why it's so important to get cap-and-trade legislation in place that can really create the investment opportunity, create the resources necessary, this $100 billion made available through auctioning off the allowances that can unleash this clean energy future. So I think the report comes at a great time. It really shows us what the stark choice is that's in front of us. It shows us what the job opportunities are, how they will benefit the environment to be sure that the investments that we're making in energy are low-carbon investments rather than exacerbating the problem, and also showing how the policy framework is necessary to get us there. So I'm happy to answer questions about that, but I think that this is a major step forward, and we look forward to working with everybody on the phone today to really make this a reality.
Great. Thank you, Francis. Now I will turn the mic over to David Foster, who is the Executive Director of the Blue-Green Alliance, a partnership between the Sierra Club and the United Steelworkers. Dave?
Thank you very much, Bracken. I wanted to take just a minute to talk about the importance and life of this study outside of policy circles and outside of Washington, D.C. The Blue-Green Alliance has joined with all the other organizations on this conference call and additional unions and environmental organizations to launch something that we've called the Green Jobs for America campaign that has been going on now for about 5 months. We've been highlighting the importance and issues of making strong investments in our environmental challenges as a way to realize future economic opportunities. It's a very simple proposition, but one that there's been a longstanding misunderstanding around. Namely, many have believed that jobs and the environment are mutually exclusive. Our campaign, along with this report, has been pointing out that, in fact, environmental investments aren't job killers. They are, in fact, the greatest job creators we have at a particularly worrisome time in our economy. So the Green Jobs for America campaign will be launching opportunities for public discussion of this report all around the country. We have events taking place this week in 7 states, and we'll continue to do this in the months to come. There isn't any more important path to economic recovery and answering our country's call to energy independence than picking up this mantle of Green Jobs for America and making this the reality of our future for our organizations and our children. And as with the others, we'd be delighted to answer questions when we're done. Thank you.
To what Dave just said, that in addition to the 7 states where there are events, there's activity of some kind going on in 32 states around the country right now. And the report covers a breakout for 34 states. I will now turn the mic over to Kathy Duval, who is the National Public Advocacy Director for the Sierra Club.
Thank you, Bracken. A lot of great speakers who have covered a lot of the points, so I'm going to keep my comments very short. A couple of years ago, the Sierra Club, in conjunction with the Steelworkers, did create the Blue-Green Alliance to promote this agenda of good jobs and a clean environment. And this summer, with a lot of the individuals and organizations on this call, we helped launch the Green Jobs for America campaign because we believe that a commitment to a clean, renewable energy is a critical step to meeting both of those goals. And that by creating a clean energy economy, we can solve multiple problems, addressing our country's energy crisis and the high cost of oil. We can create manufacturing and other jobs to replace some of the more than 600,000 jobs lost in this last year alone, and we can really move America away from an energy economy based on fossil fuels to clean renewable energy sources, and in that way address global warming. Like Francis and other leaders in the environmental community, I find myself spending an awful lot of time talking about economics these days. And when you sort of step back and think about it, the environmental community has very much embraced the green jobs and economic development agenda that comes with it, which is, as Dave mentioned, just a real different frame on how to think about a bunch of these issues. It's also, though, very exciting to be spending my time talking about solutions. We know from our nation's capital to living rooms across the country that people are talking about the high cost of energy and the impact on the economy. And we see daily polls to show people that show people actually know we're headed in the wrong direction and that they're looking for actual solutions. This report really demonstrates that the solutions to these serious problems, climate change and a struggling economy, are both intertwined and within our grasp. And we look forward to working with public officials at all levels of government to really help identify the investments and opportunities necessary so we can take the next steps to implement the benefits that this report outlines.
Great. Thank you very much, Kathy. Now I'd like to introduce Van Jones, who is the president of Green for All. Van?
Thank you. I am Van Jones. I am the president of Green for All. Green for All is a national organization. We are working to build an inclusive green economy, one that is strong enough to lift millions of people out of poverty. So our focus is poverty. Our core constituencies are low-income people and people of color, what we call the unlikely faces in the unlikely places, the people you haven't heard from a lot yet in the debate on climate or energy policy, but we're bringing those voices forward. We are proud to be a part of the Apollo Alliance. We're proud to be a supporter of the Blue-Green Alliance. We're proud to work closely with the Center for American Progress, where I'm a senior fellow, along with Bracken. We're also proud to point out that September 27th is a National Day of Action, in part inspired by some of the insights of this report, called Green Jobs Now. There are already more than 200 actions and rallies planned coast to coast the day after the first presidential debates. Campuses, housing projects, Native American reservations, black churches, people of all colors and classes are going to be standing up and saying, on the basis of this report, we're ready for green jobs. We want green jobs now. That's September 27th. My comments are these. We are in an economic crisis, an energy crisis, and a climate crisis. Any crisis creates opportunity. It's our view that poor people and people of color have no interest in clinging fingers and toes to a pollution-based economy that has given us asthma, cancer, and very few jobs. This report proves there is more work, more wealth, and more health available for low-income people and people of color in a clean and green economy than we have in the present economy. There are not a lot of jobs in the coal mines anymore. There are not a lot of jobs on the oil rigs, but there are millions of jobs available in rebooting, retrofitting, and repowering this nation. And we want to be a part of those jobs. From an economic perspective, from an energy perspective, from the earth climate perspective, this is the work that most needs to be done. Rebooting and retrofitting the country is the work that most needs to be done. At the same time, we have thousands of people in our communities who desperately need work. Urban youth, rural youth, recently displaced workers, returning veterans, people coming home from prison. All these people desperately need work. We want to connect the people who most need work to the work that most needs to be done and fight pollution and poverty at the same time. This report shows it's possible. It's not pie in the sky. It's very practical. It's very pragmatic. We want to get started. Last, I will say this approach is not just right for people's jobs. It's also right for two other important P's, the planet and energy prices. The climate crisis is not just an elite issue. It's an issue for everyday people to worry about. Low-income people and people of color have no interest in staying on a path toward more floods, more droughts, more wildfires, more Katrina-style hurricanes. So we need to get off of the present pathway onto a new one. It's also right for energy prices. The best way to get prices down is to cut demand for energy through massive weatherization and expand supply with renewables. This is a much better approach on price for energy. I'd rather not listen to Newt Gingrich on how to get our prices down. I'd rather listen to Adam Smith, and that's what this approach is all about. I'm glad to be on the call. Happy to take questions.
Thank you, Van. And in closing for the formal presentation portion of this call, I'm going to turn the mic over to someone who's working in the field. Jen Jannon is the Pennsylvania State Director and Acting Program Director for Working America, a project of the AFL-CIO. Jen?
Great. Thank you so much for having me. So as Bracken said, I'm going to speak very briefly about the work that Working America has done out in the field. And this is something we've done in partnership with the Sierra Club, going out and talking to our members at their homes about green jobs. And you know, I think that what we've found, it really illustrates the high level of support that's out there in the community on this issue. So just some background, Working America is the community affiliate of the AFL-CIO, and we reach out to folks on economic issues, and specifically we reach out to folks who don't have a union on the job. And we have 2.5 million members across the country, and they're mostly concentrated in industrial states where job loss and creating new jobs is one of the most key issues. And so the project that we've worked on has involved engaging our members through our door-to-door canvas in three of our biggest states, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Minnesota. And combined in those states, we knock on over 16,000 working families' doors every night. So we've really had the opportunity to speak to thousands and thousands of people about a green energy economy. And even though our members are largely working class folks who get active because they want to take action on issues like health care and jobs and the economy, what we found is that we had a hugely popular response from our members. Now, we boiled this down essentially to two key imperatives. The first is creating new worker-friendly jobs here in America that will stay here in America. And the second was helping to create more energy choices and curbing skyrocketing costs. So just share with you a few of the emerging themes that we found. First of all, our members are telling us constantly that they're feeling the pressure of skyrocketing energy costs coupled with a lack of good-paying jobs. And so it was completely intuitive to them. Right away, they understood that a green energy economy could offer huge economic benefits and relief to their families. You know, we also hear all the time that folks are struggling to get by and that they want to see an attention paid to new strategies for economic growth. And they were so supportive and excited to hear about green jobs as a specific laid-out solution for rebuilding America's manufacturing base, and particularly supportive of the fact that these will be good-paying jobs, hopefully with benefits and also the right to organize collectively. You know, we heard at many doors across the country where we worked on this that people just wanted us to contact them if these jobs did come to their area because they wanted one. And then finally, our members were by and large shocked that their communities weren't already investing in bringing this green energy economy to their communities. And they expressed again and again that they wanted to see their city or their state really get out front and take the lead in making sure that those jobs came to their area. So, you know, we feel like this has been a critical and important issue for our members. They're eager to learn more about it and take action, and they've embraced it as part of a solution to rebuilding our economy. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jen. And now all of our listeners will, all of our speakers will be available for answering questions. So we will turn it over to folks on the line.
Thank you. The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. Questions will be taken in the order they were received. If you are using a speakerphone, we ask that while posing your question, you pick up your handset to provide favorable sound quality. If at any time your question has been answered, you can remove yourself from the queue by pressing the pound sign. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question or comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. Please hold while we poll for questions.
And as we take questions, please introduce yourself by name and organizational affiliation. That'll be helpful.
Thank you. Our first question comes from Ed Fraunheim from Workforce Management Magazine. Please state your question.
Hi, I'm with Workforce Management Magazine, and we're curious about the angle of green jobs and a green economy from an HR perspective, and curious about what you all might say about how companies are going to be able to find the kind of people that will take these green jobs, what kind of recruiting or training differences need to be out there, and what does it take, for example, to turn an auto worker into a wind turbine worker? Are these things easy to do or hard to do?
Let me comment on that. It's Leo Girard. I think it's important that we recognize that it's not necessarily just about converting an auto worker into a wind turbine manufacturer. It's about making energy-efficient vehicles so that an auto worker can make automobiles. Let me give you one example that I wanted to make in my comments, and I didn't do it. As a result of the out-of-sight gasoline prices for automobiles, we believe from the work that we've seen, and we're going to be talking about it with the tire companies, that so far this year, Americans have driven several billions of miles less than had been projected. As a result of driving several billions of miles less, there's less tires that need to be produced, and we've got a problem then in the tire industry. So if we had energy-efficient vehicles, maybe there'd be not that kind of reduction in miles driven. There wouldn't be an increase in carbon emissions. There'd be affordable energy that people could use, and people would be making tires for green automobiles. In the steel industry, as I said, we've had now several hundred people employed in the steel plate industry making plate for windmills. We represent 1,000 plus people at Gamesa in Pennsylvania that are now building windmills that weren't building them 5 years ago as a result of Governor Rendell bringing in a renewable energy standard. That has caused to develop new training programs at community colleges in the communities where those windmills are being produced. And we've now got workers who had been dislocated on steel company properties when the steel industry went down, who have been retrained and are now making windmills and wind turbines and wind turbine blades that are in a unionized environment and are going to be earning family-supporting jobs. So there's three good examples. And again, if you retrofit low-hanging fruit from public buildings and incent private buildings to do it, the parts to do that will come from glass factories where glass workers already know how to make that. It'll come from air handling factories where workers know how to make that. It'll come from the building and construction trades that are very well qualified in retrofitting buildings and building new green buildings. So it's not just about retraining people, although that's going to be an element of it, as I said, with Gamesa. It's also creating an environment where people can make what they're already making, but make it for a green economy. And that can translate into millions of new jobs and millions of people who will maintain the jobs they have.
This is John Jones from Green for All. The other aspect of what Leo's talking about is that we do want for our community colleges, our vocational schools, our public high schools to be supported in getting people to the front of the line for these new clean and green jobs and not in the back of the line for the last entries, pollution-based jobs that are leaving the country anyway. Practically, there's something called the Green Jobs Act, which Congress passed and George Bush signed into law last year, which is supposed to get money through the Department of Labor to begin helping our community colleges and our job trainers at the local level to begin creating green tracks and green trade programs. Unfortunately, the money still has not been allocated, but we think that our job trainers need support at the community level to begin getting our job seekers ready for these new green jobs.
This is David Foster from the Blue Green Alliance, and I would just add to what Leo and Van have said that, as we've often stated, green jobs are just blue-collar jobs with a green purpose. And one of the things that this study does that is very helpful is debunk the myth that the green economy is something to be afraid of, that it somehow is asking workers to take on skills that they haven't yet been trained for technologies that haven't yet been invented. The study really identifies that the skills to build the green economy are well in hand of the American worker. And it's a question of our making these investments, which will reinvigorate the economy that we've got and put it to purpose to solve our environmental problem.
Bob Poland, just briefly, to follow up on Dave, yes, on page 6 of the study itself, there is a table where we list the representative jobs associated with the 6 green investment strategies. And we put that in for a purpose. Precisely to address this kind of question, which is to show that most of the jobs that are going to be created by the program we outline or any other green jobs program are going to be people doing pretty much what they have been doing, but for different projects. So, of course, there's going to be retraining. There's going to be new opportunities. There's going to be things to be done at the junior colleges and so forth, as Van Jones says. But for the most part, these are jobs that are already out there. There's going to be a lot of jobs, for example, for lawyers, for accountants, for secretaries, for truck drivers, for our railroad engineers. That's going to be part of the project.
Thank you.
Very good, and we'll take another.
Our next question comes from Christina Rousseau from USolar. Please state your question.
Hi, my name is Christina Rousseau. I'm an independent energy consultant, and up on the November ballot, we are facing a tough decision as environmentalists and as renewable energy specialists and as voters in general. And it's a pretty ambitious, pretty progressive proposition that's going to be on the bill that's going to be mandating clean renewable energy by 51% standards, then up to 75% standards, and by 2020, 100% standard by the year 2020. However, what I'm finding really scary about this is that it basically states that no voter approval would be necessary, so the Board of Supervisors would actually be the ones that are voting on all of our energy measures that would be put into place. The other problem that I'm seeing is that there is an opt-in, opt-out measure of this ballot measure, and under the current contract that most large corporations in our cities have with the existing utility companies, it is in my opinion that these large companies would opt out, especially in the first years, because of contracts, and B, because of the cost.
Okay, can you frame this as a question? We've got a very limited amount of time.
Getting there. So it seems to me that the residents would be responsible. So how do we face issues on ballot measures that are really progressive, really ambitious, but do not make sense when it comes to actually mandating and implementing these laws?
This is Bracken Hendricks from Center for American Progress. I think one of the underlying principles behind this paper is that too much responsibility is being placed on localities and on businesses and individuals. We need national leadership. We need visionary direction for the country to move forward. What we're trying to articulate here is an investment agenda that fits into a broader program for really tackling the climate challenge, really managing our economy in a way that promotes growth and broadly shared prosperity and opportunity. And hopefully it won't be a burden that's borne by local governments around the country, although local leadership has been instrumental in moving forward to this time. Can we take the next?
Yeah, this is Frances Beinecke. Let me just follow up on that. I think your point is exactly right, that what this program envisions is a national policy that sets the standard to reduce carbon emissions, creates the investment and the policy at a national level so that it can be a a program across the country. I think what's happening now in the last number of years, with the vacuum of leadership on these issues, there are a lot of initiatives in the states, ballot initiatives, other things. They have actually taken us very far down the road, but fundamentally, it requires a national response. We're talking about a climate crisis that, as Leo mentioned earlier, is global, at a global scale, and we need both a national response and a global response. And even well-meaning measures at the local level, if they're not designed well, they can't solve this problem. So that's really what we're all looking for, is how do we unleash national leadership at the policy level to face global warming and get the economy moving in a clean energy future.
Great.
I couldn't agree with you more, and it's pretty scary that this might happen, because it's doomed to fail. So if there's any way I can speak with someone on an individual basis,
sure. We'll take that offline, but I think the next question, we'd love to take another question as well.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Brian Chappell from CD Publications. Please state your question.
Yes, hi, thank you. I'll be more direct. I was just hoping you could expand a little more on just how the retrofitting of public buildings and housing would go through as the study reads. I mean, and among other things, is the construction workforce and those, 800,000 people that lost their jobs, are they ready to implement these kind of improvements properly?
This is Bob Polin from UMass. As we mentioned before, most of the retrofitting projects are going to involve people doing things not that different from what they already are doing. In fact, here at UMass, I have a colleague who is leading the National Science Foundation research project on building retrofits. And I worked with him in developing some of these suggestions with respect to retrofits. So, of course, there's going to be specialized skills that have been used but are going to be used more, like knowing where there's air pockets in buildings and then knowing how to pull out insulation and tighten up buildings in ways that haven't been done before. But these aren't considered dramatic stretches from the kinds of skill sets that people already have. So I think our workforce is well prepared to undertake these projects.
This is Leo Gerard. Let me add to that the comment that I made, that if we were to retrofit buildings to current, even to just current science, current standards, we would have huge, huge energy savings and a huge reduction in carbon emissions. We've got public buildings all over the place that were built prior to the first or prior to the Second World War. We've got a ton of buildings that were built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s that were using old technology. We've got now, as an example, glass that is energy efficient, just repairing and replacing that glass. We've got much more efficient air handling systems. We've got the capacity to put photovoltaic cells on rooftops. We have the capacity to change the color of rooftops so that they are less heat intensive. We have the ability to keep buildings warmer in the winter and cooler in the summer by just doing those kinds of things. And our construction industry, both to make it and to replace and install the new equipment, are totally qualified, and we could expand both production and construction jobs. This isn't rocket science. And so if we had a program of taking the buildings that are publicly owned and investing in retrofitting them, and we took the buildings that were all pre-1960 and put them on a retrofitting schedule at both the municipal, state, and federal level, we would make a huge difference in carbon emissions, and we would make a huge increase in jobs, both, and in particular if we said that if we're going to use domestic dollars, then it's going to be manufactured domestically. We would have a huge impact on jobs, and we would incent universities and centers of higher learning to do the kind of research about how do we make the next level of energy efficiency in retrofitting and designing buildings even more accessible. I think this is and to be very blunt about it, this is a no-brainer for the return on investment. It's much greater than we're currently getting by investing in the damn stock market.
This is John Podesta. I would say just add two things directly to the question. This is already being undertaken in state and municipalities around the country. And what I think that this program aims at is trying to increase those programs by matching state level funds, so that we'd have a massive expansion with additional federal dollars, as well as providing tax relief for activities on the private building side that would begin to create the right kinds of incentives for residential building owners as well as commercial building owners to take on what's happening, again, in cities and states around the country with great effect. So I think we see the future in current activity, but it needs to be expanded and sort of blown out across the country.
This is David Foster from the Blue-Green Alliance. I would just add that this is an area where both the benefits of the energy savings and the job creation have been well substantiated in European countries. Europeans, I think it's commonly known, use about 50% less energy per capita than we do here in the United States. And at its recent report to a UN conference on global warming solutions, the German government reported on the job creation benefits that for every billion euros that they've invested in energy efficient building retrofitting, they've created 25,000 permanent jobs. So as others have said, this isn't rocket science. It's well demonstrated, and the benefits both in terms of energy cost savings and job creation are well substantiated.
Great. Next caller.
This is one last point. This is Van Jones from Green for All. I think three things. One is, it's certainly the case that often people talk about the green economy. People start thinking about Buck Rogers, technology they've never seen before. And, the main technology we're talking about here is, in some cases is, caulk guns and hand drills. This is stuff that, we know how to do, and we're just not doing it. Secondly, it's not automatic, though. You might get off the call and think, well, geez, all this stuff is so obvious. It does require leadership, and it does require leadership from the public sector to get the incentives right to get the initial investment going. And that's why we think it's so important that we not leave all of this opportunity on the ground when there's so much need for jobs in the country. The last thing, it's not automatic that the people who most need the jobs will get the jobs. And that's why it's so important that we engage our community colleges, our community-based organizations to make sure that people who are ready to work and who want to work, who may not have found work in the old pollution-based economy, are given the support they need to get involved in this new green and clean economy. That's the best way to bring community violence down, the best way to bring struggling communities up is to make sure that the communities that were left out of the pollution-based economy get locked into this clean and green economy.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Ann Shahid from Audubon. Please state your question.
I just need for someone to go over the names of the speakers. I didn't catch all the names, if someone could do that.
Excellent. I'm Bracken Hendricks. I'm the moderator. We have John Podesta, the president and CEO of the Center for American Progress, Bob Polin, the co-director of the Perry Political Economy Research Institute at University of Massachusetts Amherst, Leo Girard, the international president of the United Steelworkers, Francis Beinecke, the president of Natural Resources Defense Council, Dave Foster, executive director of the Blue-Green Alliance, Kathy Duvall, the national public advocacy director of Sierra Club, Van Jones, the president of Green for All, and Jen Jannen, the Pennsylvania state director and acting program director of Working America. We also are going to have a recording of this call available on the Center for American Progress website shortly, and that will be another opportunity to review any of this material if that's helpful to you.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Doug Obey from InsideEPA.com. Please state your question.
Hi. Most of the discussion around this report seems to pretty much cast this as, you know, table setting for next year. At the national level, new Congress, new administration. I wanted to follow up and ask, is there any of what this report is identifying or what you're proposing that might still be taken up now, even if there's just small pieces of it on the Hill?
Certainly, this is Van Jones from Green for All. Certainly the Green Jobs Act of 2007, which is signed into law and needs to be appropriated, I think it's about $125 million, which is not a lot of money. It's enough to train about 30,000 people a year. Congress is still wrestling with that. That's something that's actionable now. Also, the U.S. Conference of Mayors has been very excited about the energy efficiency and conservation block grant, what we call the so-called green block grant, that will make a lot of money available to cities to weatherize and retrofit. So there are actionable pieces that are moving through Congress that reflect the wisdom of this report. I'll leave it to others to point out other opportunities. But Congress right now needs to move on the Green Jobs Act, needs to move on the energy efficiency and conservation block grants. We can go ahead and get started now rebooting and retrofitting the country.
This is with Sierra Club. There's other issue that's current in Congress right now is the production tax credits and investment tax credits for renewable energy, and that those are ways to, you know, sort of spur the development of some of these alternative energy sources that would then create jobs and, in effect, keep jobs, since there are people who are out there doing things right now that could lose their jobs if Congress fails to renew those tax credits.
And John Podesta, the House leadership today is announcing a package in terms of an emergency stimulus bill that contains some money, I think, on the investment side, and the Senate will soon consider and take up an emergency supplemental, which there's been at least a bipartisan request led by Senators Sanders, Clinton, Collins, and Menendez to add money for the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant, the Green Jobs Workforce Training Program, and Low-Income Weatherization Assistance Program. So, yes, there's, I think, at the tail end of this Congress, there's some opportunity to both appropriate and push forward some of the ideas that are included in this report. What the report calls for, though, is doing that at a larger scale, and I think that it will, in the end of the day, be more relevant in the new Congress that will convene in January.
Another question?
Yeah, just a quick follow-up. Do you see this green jobs focus being something that happens in tandem with discussions on a cap and trade bill, or supplementary to it, or prior to it? How do you see that happening next year?
Francis may want to comment on this as well. Again, it's John Podesta, but I noted at the outset of the call that the direction of this stimulus and growth package is contained in a larger package that CAPS put forward looks for an energy transformation from a high carbon to a low carbon base taking place over a longer period of time, approximately 10 years. And we, in that original package, suggested that could be funded through the use of an auction-based cap and trade system. But again, I think it's important to note that this work needs to be done to both address the climate crisis that's been mentioned, the energy crisis we face today, and the economic crisis that the country is currently in the middle of. So if this needs to be advanced in advance of the ability to get a cap and trade through, we think that would be wise. But ultimately, the money that is developed from a cap and trade could be used for these kinds of investments. Francis, do you want to?
Yeah, thanks, John. Francis Beinecke, NRDC. I just add that in the design of the cap and trade legislation that's been under discussion and will continue to be going into the new Congress, having an auction of the allowances designed into the program to create the funds that could really launch this and put a major investment, we think is a critical component of it. I think that what's important about this report is it's a $100 billion investment. We need to transform our energy future and our energy economy. It requires that size investment, and the best source of that is to auction off the allowances in the cap and trade program.
This is Bracken Hendricks here. I think the bottom line is that this report shows that investing in green economic transition and green energy systems creates more jobs, and it creates more good jobs. And this is an exciting potential as we start to approach a cap and trade debate and take climate policy seriously. We need to recognize that this is a very sound strategy for rebuilding our economy. I guess we'll take maybe one more question, and then I'll let John Podesta close. And
our last question comes from Rob Harper from Missoula Independent. Please state your question.
Hi. Earlier speaker had talked about both the investments per state and the jobs created would be equitably distributed across the U.S. I'm from a small western state and was wondering, state per state, what's the investment and jobs creation ratio like?
Hi, this is Bob Poland. Now, of course, it's not up to me to really allocate $100 billion state by state, but what we tried to do in the report was to come up with the equitable procedures for allocating the money and then to estimate what the effects would be state by state through an equitable procedure. And the formula that we worked with, and again, it's just a starting point for thinking, is to say that one way to equitably distribute the money is according to population, so that every person in the country gets their equal share of $100 billion, and that would be one way to break it down by state. Another way to think about it is that each state gets money based on what the level of GDP is in each state, what the overall level of the economy is. There are merits to both ways and problems with both ways. We discussed them in the study. And so what we decided was we would divide the money based on both procedures. We used both procedures and then took a midpoint as to what would result from both procedures. And what we have in the report is a table that shows the according to the technique I just described, we showed how much money gets distributed. That's on page 27, state by state, according to this formula. And again, I'm not claiming that this is the way it has to be done, but I think at least gives us a picture as to a fair way to distribute the money, and that what the effect would be on employment in each community, each state, based on that distribution approach.
Do you want to give my hand?
I think we're at the stage of closing up. This is John Podesta again. I'll let Bracken give the final contact information. But to give you some indication of that, and I would reference everybody on the call to that state-by-state analysis. I think it's quite important. As Bob mentioned, it doesn't have to be done this way, but we think this is an equitable way to do it. And Montana, for example, based on what the caller was suggesting, which already has a relatively low unemployment rate relevant to the national picture, which could see its unemployment rate fall below 3% with this kind of an investment package. And I think that's what's so exciting and important about this, which is at a time when people need to be put back to work, this is a highly efficient way of creating jobs, keeping them in the United States, distributing them across the country, distributing them across income classification, if you will, job skill classification, and as Van has pointed out over and over again, to bring people into the economy who need work and need jobs in a way that will produce long-term gains from an energy perspective and an energy cost perspective, and necessary gains from a climate perspective. So we think that this ought to be taken up by Congress, and we hope that these down payments could conceivably be made in this Congress, and that a full discussion of an investment program like this will be taken up when a new Congress and a new president come to Washington in January.
Great. Well, I guess this closes the press call, but I want to remind folks that we will have a recording of this call available on the Center for American Progress website very shortly. The website is www.americanprogress.org. In addition, if you have particular questions or want to track down folks who spoke today for further quotes or comments, please contact John Neuroer at the Center for American Progress, J-N-E-U-R-O-H-R, at AmericanProgress.org, and he can also be reached by telephone at 202-481-8182. I want to thank all of our callers and the Green Jobs for America campaign, as well as from the Center for American Progress and Perry at University of Massachusetts. Thank you very much for taking the time, and look forward to being available to you moving forward.
Thanks, Bracken.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. This does conclude today's teleconference. We thank you for your participation. You may disconnect your lines at this time and have a great day.